Welcome back, everyone, to Your Ball Was Out podcast by Phil from Tweener Head Tennis. Now, today we have probably one of the most infamous voices in commentary when it comes to professional tennis with Robbie Koenig. Now, Robbie's been around the business for such a long time and probably one of the most recognizable voices on the streams when it comes to men's tennis. Now, we were very grateful to have Robbie on not too long ago. It was great to have Robbie join the podcast and have him talk about his experience and what it's like to call some of the most famous and most memorable matches on the ATP Tour. Before you guys enjoy our chat with Robbie, make sure you check out today's sponsor of the podcast, the Universal Tennis Power Subscription Service. Not only do you get to see a more detailed number to see where you stack up against your opponents and other players on the UTR Sports website, but you also get power perks. Includes 30% off Tennis Warehouse, 30% off Total Pickleball, 35% off the UTR Shop, 25% off Diadem, $30 off Whoop, and 20% off Print, and so much more. If you are interested in that and you're interested in supporting the podcast and the YouTube channel, make sure to check out the link in the description and the bio of this podcast. Now, without further ado, enjoy our interview with infamous tennis commentator Robbie Koenig.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is a rare occasion because we probably have one of, and this is not because he's on the channel now, but it's because of how long he's been doing this and how iconic his voice is. We have Robbie, who's been doing this for how long would you say right now?
Hey, Phil, thanks for the kind words, but 16 years now, and I haven't worked a day in my life. I've been so blessed to do this thing. I mean, just look at the guys that we've had around the sport for the last 15, 16 years, Phil.
Yeah.
It's been unbelievable to be around and calling these matches. Count my blessings every day, and I absolutely love my job.
It's amazing how recognizable your voice is now. If you're a tennis fan and if you've been in the tennis space, your voice has such a unique sound. When did you get into this, and how did you know you would end up not working for the rest of your life?
It's funny you say that. I've told the story a couple of times, but you know Jason Goodall, who works on the tennis channel now. Jason and I have an apartment in Southfields, and I was walking, which is the suburb right next door to Wimbledon. In fact, you get off at the Southfields tube station to get to Wimbledon. So I'm walking to the tube station. I come around this corner and I bump into Jason, and it's like I haven't seen him in a couple of years. I know he was working on Tim Henman's website, and I didn't know what he was up to. And he's like, oh, what are you doing here? And I'm like, no, I've got an apartment just up the road. I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's like, no, I've got an apartment just up the road. I need to realize we live three driveways away from one another. And so he said, what are you doing? This is 2006, the year after I've just retired. And I said to him, I'm coaching. I'm working with Mahesh Bhupathi and Wesley Moody. They're playing dubs together. Wesley's playing singles. And so, yeah, retired last year, but obviously back on tour doing some weeks coaching. And I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, no, I'm working for ATP Media. You know, I've got this new company. I've been around for a couple of years, and I've been doing commentary for them for 2 years, you know. And
yeah.
Is commentary something you'd be interested in getting into? And I said, no, not really. And I'm just started this coaching gig. It's going well. He goes, well, John Barrett is retiring at the end of the year. John Barrett,
okay.
Mr. Wimbledon for, you know, those of us who grew up watching tennis in the UK and listening to, you know, those world feeds from Wimbledon. You just grew up with John, and John was turning 80 and he was done commentating, and they were looking for somebody, ATP Media. It was Doug Adler, Jason and John. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Phil, he said, well, if you ever got a gap at some of the tournaments, why don't you pop your head into the booth? And, you know, we're only three guys commentating all day. We need all the help we can get. So I just went in there to chat tennis with them. And I remember doing a couple of sets in Indian Wells in Miami when I finished training with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then same thing happened in, I think, Rome. And then actually after Wimby that year, Wesley Moody and I split up. And
Okay. Suddenly
it was like, wow, okay, hang on, this coaching thing, there's no guarantees, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember visiting with him one more time in Canada, and actually in Cincinnati the following week, the executive producer came and said, hey, Robbie, you know, we really like you as a commentator.
Mm-hmm.
would you be interested in commentating for us next year? You know, back then, nobody really knew too much about the World Feed and ATP Media. But I just had the experience in the coaching capacity where I got axed by half of my team. And it was like, you know, I like the sound. You laugh, but it's so true, man. I like the sound of having a fixed income. And, you know, guaranteed all these weeks' work. And, you know, he said, how much do you want to get paid? And I said, this much. And he said, well, we don't even pay John Barrett that much. How about we pay you this much? And I said, no, that's too little. And we basically met somewhere in the middle. And following year, I started commentating thanks to that chance meeting with Jason
in
the corner of Church Road and Bathgate Road.
We gotta put a staple or a flag that says this is where Robbie started his career. that's like a plaque.
Yeah,
all it's one of the
starting door moments, right?
Yeah, it's, and no one ever knows when their big opportunity is going to come, and no one knows what's going to affect their life. And for you, with this gig, I feel like it's one of those where you've had the experience going in of knowing the sport, coaching the sport, and how much of your background came into play when doing these commentaries. How much would you say your background helped this amazing opportunity that you have?
That's a good question. I tell you what I think helped me the most was that as a player, because I had no weapons, I was very analytical. I could work out opponents quickly, what their strengths and weaknesses were. And that was figuring out opponents quickly. And that analytical side that I had to my game, I think has served me well as a broadcaster, because I could explain the tactics behind what is happening.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously you learn to hone that skill, but I think my greatest ability in those early days was that, just to explain what is going on. And more importantly, not so much what is going on, but why it's going on.
Yeah.
You know, what that forehand there means to set up that shot there. And the pattern of play thereafter, 80% of the time is the guy will pass there. So watch out for that. And that's something that Roger does well. It's something that Andy does very well. You know, it might be something that another player doesn't do well. So let's see if Phil can, you know, exploit the forehand side of Robbie.
Yeah. And for you too, and we'll get into this more, but your son's now a college athlete.
Yeah.
And he's playing at Baylor. That's how I reached out to Robbie first. Seeing that kind of play out for you, how much insight did you give your son, who's now playing at a top school in the United States? How much of that analytical side has your son heard from Coach Robbie or announcer Robbie?
In his words, probably too much, Phil. You know, you're always trying to get that fine line between being a parent and a coach and just dad, right? You just want to be and help him as much as you can. But sometimes they don't want to hear it from you. And, you know, you're always trying to find that balance. And as he's got older, he kind of tells me when he's heard it enough. And he's still trying to slip those messages in there all the time. And it's like, Dad, enough, right? So I think my job was to try and make him as self-sufficient as he could possibly be. I would think I've done my job if Luke can figure out situations on the tennis court. And, you know, you leave it at that, because I think sometimes the best way to learn is to fail, without a doubt. And I try to encourage him to be adventurous, take risks, and learn from them. I think that's probably one of the reasons why I think I was a good learner, because I didn't have much analytical coaching and we had to figure it out ourselves. It was myself and Kevin Elliott and Ellis Ferreira. I mean, those other two guys have won majors. You know, we all come from, Ellis and I come from the same high school. Kevin Elliott, you know, won the US Open with Wayne Black. He won Aussie as well with Wayne. You know, you're talking about a radius of about 30 kilometers is where we all came from. We never had majorly structured coaching. So Yeah, I think we figured things out playing amongst a group of players where there were about 10 or 12 of us. Phil, a lot of those guys ended up going to college at the very least. Many of them went pro. I'd say half of them went pro, including myself. So it was good tennis on a daily basis, just good old going at it, hammer and tongs, figuring out yourself. The coach wasn't in your ear every 5 minutes. So I think that helped all of us. And I think from a broadcasting perspective, it's still one of my strengths today. Even watching new players, I can pick up nuances quite quickly. And so it's almost easier when you're removed, when you're not on the match court. Because sometimes you're thinking of other things in the match court, you're worrying about yourself. But of course, from the commentary box, you've got analytics from Hawkeye helping us. And then, you know, you're watching it from a neutral position and you can you focus on things pretty quickly and hopefully grasp the situation.
You actually said something very interesting there when it came to that outside perspective. We always say that people do this for this reason, or they did this to do that. But from, I guess, that fan perspective of the angles that we are only able to see through our TV or any screen, it's hard to understand what that setup is like, especially when that angle is high up. And I think a lot of people in the tennis world like that angle from right behind the players. Yeah. So that way they can see the height of the ball, where they're going exactly. And do you think it's hard for people to understand if they're not sitting on the court, how difficult it may be? Or when they say, oh, but they could have just gone there. But if you think about it, if they didn't, it would have been completely different.
So I think that's going to be one of the most important things for the sport going forward is how do we showcase these guys' athleticism, the power, the spin, obviously that camera two angle where it's much lower. It's interesting. I often do a poll about it. And I'm surprised at the mixed reactions I get from it, Phil.
Really? Why?
Yeah, I am. And I don't know, you know, the average age of the tennis viewer, certainly in the UK here, where I'm broadcasting mostly for Amazon now, is 62 years of age. So I don't know if it's an age-related thing or not, but I just thought automatically more people would love the lower angle, but I reckon it's about 50-50.
Wow.
Maybe 60-40 in favor of the lower angle. I thought it would be overwhelmingly in favor of showcasing the sport, I think, in a better light.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, without a doubt, I think tennis is such an athletic sport. If I see sometimes, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of NBA and they go down on the court there and you're with the guys running and they're in your grill, they're slam dunking it. You get a real feel for what's going on rather than the wide angle on the side of the court. So I think for our sport, these guys are some of the best athletes. I'm biased. I think they're the best athletes in the world. I think what you have to do to be a world-class tennis player, there's no other sport like it. I argue with everybody about it. Whatever your arguments are, bring it. I'm prepared to take one.
I've seen you argue with people. I've seen you argue with people on Twitter when it says, what's the most athletic sport? And I think tennis is definitely one of top five, maybe, because I've also contributed the same athleticism that tennis involves is hockey. That's the only other sport I can see tennis as difficult because of using your entire body, using your hand-eye coordination, mental toughness, physical toughness, balance, everything like that. That's the only other sport in my mind that I think tennis is comparable to.
Yeah. Hey, but those guys have got teammates, right?
Yeah, that's true. Okay. I see what you mean, Robbie. See, is the argument that Robbie has on Twitter where now I'm getting caught and he's going to correct me.
Well, it's a discussion I'd love to have. Get us a basketball player and a golfer. Golfers are often the ones that, you know, talk about how difficult golf is as a sport. And my first comeback, it's cheeky, is that golf isn't a sport, right? It's a game. I mean, it is that classic quote from Andre Agassi. And again, I don't know if Andre was saying it in jest. And he said, how can it be a sport if you wear a belt? So, brilliant, man. That was brilliant. And listen, if Andre says it, it's good enough for me.
To be honest, I've never heard that line before. So I'm very happy I did hear that. For someone who teaches at a country club and golf is the primary, I guess I have to use the air quotes here, sport for the club.
Yeah,
I think that's a very good point. And when it comes to that side of it, if you were to give, and this just popped into my head when it came to talking about your son, is if you were to give a piece of advice to a tennis parent, what would it be?
It's freaking hard sport. It's one of the toughest sports. It's got so much more expensive now to play the sport. You have to be either European based. If I had to break it down geographically, you either got to be in Europe. Europe is so easy. If you have a European base, your access to drive everywhere and is fantastic. You know, if I was a big tennis federation like Australia, I'd buy a couple of condos or something in Europe and have that option for my players to tap into Europe.
Especially,
you know, those guys are away from Australia for so long. Same for some of the South American guys. I remember having this conversation with Diego Schwartzman. It might have even been last year or the year before at Queens. And he was saying, Robbie, you know, how tough it is for him that he can't just pop back home to Argentina. He's got to stay in Europe for so long. Just wants to, you know, touch base with his roots and his mates. And it's difficult to do that. So, you know, South America, obviously very strong tennis heritage, but Europe's where it's at right now. You have a look at the rankings. You just break the rankings down. The U.S. is doing well at the moment for whatever reason. Is a
good
for young guys. So that's nice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a big market. I think it's so important for the sport. France is doing well now as we have this chat. Nice to see him in the finals of the cross-court tournament. Taylor lighting it up.
Yeah, especially if he's going to make top 10 if he wins the final. So that's going to be huge if they do, because it won't be Fritz or Isner. It would be another guy that actually shows their potential. Yes. And I agree. It's funny that you say that, because when it comes to dealing with others asking, oh, what country has the best tennis? I don't think you can say one country has the best tennis. I think every country has one athlete that's better than the others, but there's no one country that develops constant top 10 players. I think it's the well-roundedness that they need to develop and having that consistency of, like, I would take Spain, for example, and the amount of talent they are able to produce and have in that top 50 slot consistently year over year makes the biggest difference, rather than having one guy in the top 20 and that's it.
But that's, you know what that is? That's culture.
Okay.
It's the culture of an incredible work ethic. I was actually commentating on paddle last weekend, a paddle event in Dubai.
Okay.
And, you know, the country that's dominating that sport is Spain and Argentina. Yes, it started there, but, you know, they've got just an incredible work ethic. It's a culture of toughness and bordering on winning at all costs. You know, they will do anything. You speak to a lot of those guys in Argentina, they've come from nothing, for nothing. They've been through some tough times. And it's not always the case. I mean, Nadal came from quite a wealthy family, but when the culture around you is like that, it's very difficult to be soft. And when things get tough, you go away. In fact, they're the opposite. They relish those tough times and they really work well as a group. You know, they'll pull you in and say, okay, but you're off kilter today. Let's get back on track. Other coaches help you. And I think it's that same culture that's manifesting itself now in American men's tennis. That there's this camaraderie community of a whole bunch of guys that are pushing one another at the moment. And I think it's very healthy. And then the young kids that come after them will see, you know, see that culture that they've developed of hardworking, tough love. And I think that'll help hopefully manifest itself for a number of years to come. It's certainly something that I think is ingrained in Spanish sport in general. I look across the board, whether it's tennis or football or cycling, you know, they've got an incredible sporting culture of being super tough.
If I was, for what I've learned, I spoke to I actually asked Jordan Thompson this once. I was like, why are all the Australians so close together? And all of them just seem to have that gamesmanship between each other because they grew up together. They all played against each other. They all know each other so well. So when they travel to different tournaments, they're always hanging out together because it's like they're being back home and it's like they're being with the friends that they've known for so long. And I'm glad you pointed out with that with the US as well, because I feel like the US is starting to develop that again, like all these other countries that have that quote unquote culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Aussies were a powerhouse for so long, especially when I was playing with so many guys around. It was a joke. There's something called the Ashes Test match that's going on. It's cricket between Australia and England that's going on right now in the UK. I remember South Africa and Australia had a healthy cricket rivalry. We used to play on the Melbourne cricket ground. We used to have 11 tennis players from Australia and 11 tennis players from South Africa, and we have a pickup game there before the Aussie Open. I mean, that's how many players there were from both our countries.
That's awesome.
Most of them were singles, most of ours were dubs. But, you know, they had so many guys, such a healthy culture with Stoltenberg and Stolle, Sandon and Rafter. There were just so many of them, Mark Philippoussis. Yeah, it definitely goes in waves. I think sometimes it's nigh on impossible to sustain those numbers. Those good tennis nations always seem to stick around.
Oh, 100%. And I think for you too, kind of going over to back to your dream job that I feel like everyone wishes they had.
Yeah.
What was your favorite moment that you called, or what's one moment that stood out to you that you'll never forget? Because I feel like you have a lot of them.
Yeah, probably two. The first one was radio, actually. For Wimbledon, I do a lot of radio as well. And I remember when Andy Murray won his first Wimbledon title, so second major, first Wimbledon, yeah. And it's so funny because Andy right now is playing in Nottingham, the Nottingham Challenger. And
final.
What's that?
He's playing a final tomorrow.
Yeah. So I just watched the post-match interview before we chatting, and he was talking about the early days when he came to Nottingham and some of the best grass courts he's ever played on. First time I discovered this young kid called Andy Murray was Nottingham at the tour event there. I played against him in doubles. I think he was about 16, couldn't believe how talented he was. Just on a grass court returning serve already back then, you could see he was something special. And I remember going up to his mum after the match. We ended up beating him and Martin Lee and saying, you know, he's fantastic. If he sticks at it, this kid's going to be a fantastic tennis player. Mm-hmm. But I followed Andy's journey since he was 16 and watched him become the player was. He has become, the struggles, whatever. But to call the final, and also even in that Wimbledon final on radio, we split the sets. So my set designation was 1, 3, and 5 if it went there. And I am the lead commentator. I'm the play-by-play. So I'm calling each shot, forehand, backhand, whatever. And then sets 2 and 4 would be another pairing. Obviously, it so happens that he beats Djokovic in straight sets. And I wanted to nail it. I always have something pre-prepared in case Djokovic wins, in case Murray wins.
And okay.
Having a Scottish grandmother, I knew exactly what, you know, what happened in Dunblane when there was that massacre where Andy's, you know, his hometown is. And it was after he won the quarterfinals, I was lying in bed thinking, what happens if Andy wins this whole thing? Creates, you know, 77 years of history, first British guy to do it since way back when. What am I going to say? And then I was just lying in bed and it just came to me in that moment. And I remember writing it down. I think it was about 11 o'clock at night. Just wrote down what I was thinking and what I wanted to include. And I just thought I nailed that moment. And I mentioned something about, you know, he's done it. Andy Murray, there'll be tears in Dunblane. And I let it pause there for a split second just to reference what had happened many years ago. But the tears would be tears of joy because one of their own, you know, has won the greatest title that the sport can have.
3 hours and 9 minutes they've been at it. Is this the time for Andy Murray? He's got a fourth championship point here at Wimbledon. Into a service action he goes. He goes out wide. Oh, what a return from Djokovic right on the baseline. He's won it! Andy Murray is Wimbledon champion! It's the second Grand Slam title of his career and he cannot believe it! He becomes the first British men's singles winner here in 77 years. And they embrace at the net. And there'll be plenty of tears shed in his hometown of Dunblane today. But there'll be tears of joy because one of their own has captured the greatest prize in all of tennis.
And in doing so, he's beaten the number one player on the planet. And I had it kind of scripted. And I just thought I got it right for that moment. And to watch the journey to culminate and be able to call it and feel like I'd done it justice, that's an incredible sense of fulfillment for me. It's the closest I could ever get to being in that moment and winning it myself, Phil. Sometimes you walk away and you think, what the hell did I just say there? You know, freaking put your dad. Can't believe it. And then sometimes, you know, every now and then you get it right. And the other one was the 2017 Aussie Open final when Federer beat Nadal. 2017, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah.
When Roger was down a break in the fifth, 3-1, obviously wins the next five games in a row. And I remember I was commentating with Mark Pitch and Josh Eagle, and I remember putting off the microphones, just looking, we all looked at one another, and we kind of said, you know, Nadal's got him again, right? Fifth set, big match, Nadal's going to get him. It just broke him to go up 3-1, and obviously Roger breaks back, goes on to win. And in that moment, to watch that happen, the quality of the tennis, you know, everything I'd watched, all of us had watched for so many years between these two, such an epic battle. It was probably, yeah, right up there with the Murray match, right up there.
I feel like I have goosebumps right now from just listening.
I'll tell you the coolest thing as well after that. We go back to the compound to say thank you to everybody. It was just Josh Eagle and myself now. We went to the compound to say cheers to everybody.
Yeah.
Josh is married to Barbara Shett. They know Roger well. Barbara interviews him all the time for Eurosport. Josh used to play same time as me, so he knows Roger too. So we're walking back underneath Rod Laver Arena to go and get transport and to leave the venue. And as we're walking, we just see all these security guards come and say, move out of the way, move out of the way. Yeah, Roger Federer coming through for press. So he's going to do all this. Yesterday, the five main TV providers has to go and do interviews with them. And we step back into this little corridor, just so this whole entourage with all these security guys, Roger, Tony was there. And as he comes around the corner, he's walking down the passage. He turns to his right and he sees me and Josh just in the alcove standing there. And he stops everybody and walks over to us and gives Josh a high five and gives me a high five. And he points to the trophy and he goes, what do you think, China? China's my nickname. It's a South Africanism. It comes from Cockney. It's like buddy. You guys say buddy in Australia the same way. Yeah. What do you think, China? It's pointing at the trophy. And I just shook my head. I said, I can't believe you won it, but China said, and he's like, never in doubt. You know, he just stopped, paused for like literally 10 seconds and then carried on walking. And it was like, just when you think the day couldn't get any cooler, you have that.
That's like, amazing.
Cool moment with a guy like Rog, and it just shows you like he knew who we were. Obviously, knows us from our playing days and commentating. But just to take a time to stop, and it was freaking cool, man. It was great.
I really don't know what to say to that because I feel like I can't top anything else that I ask you from that story. It's
probably my other best thing that I've ever done was when Federer and Nadal came to play Roger's charity match in South Africa.
Oh, you did that one as well? That was incredible.
That was even better. So I emceed that. Bill Gates, Trevor Noah there, obviously Roger. But let me tell you what, the biggest applause noise I've ever heard. That 57,000 people watching it,
yeah,
in a football stadium, was when Roger's mom came
really
to the court and I interviewed her. Obviously, she's South African.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the people went mental for, I mean, they were fired up for Roger and Rafa, but just a whole different level when Lynette came on.
That's and amazing.
Obviously, just the vibe around Cape Town for, we got there a couple of days before, the vibe around the city. You know, I'm fortunate that I get to watch them play a lot, but it was so cool to be in my own country. And these two buggers were rolling into town and the whole of the country was just talking about this match. And then, you know, getting to be part of that occasion for the charity, you know, so those three things are all right up there with things that I've done.
It's incredible. And I feel like there's so much more that you have to offer and so much more that you can do with your dream job. And I'm going to leave you with one question too. And because thank you again for doing this. I really do appreciate it. How do you keep your voice? How do you keep from losing your voice?
It's like anything.
You really? Know, I think it's nothing special?
No, nothing special. Just talk a lot. Get used to it. It's like going to the gym a lot. You get fit. Run a lot. You get fit. Well, in the early days, when I was working with Jason and Doug, because there were only three of us, your hours were long, but yeah, were long and brutal. I remember the guys that sit next to us at ESPN on the one side, Fox on the other side, back in those days in the States. And they'd do one match and they were out of there, maybe two matches. And we were there first ball to last ball, whether it was center court, if there was still live tennis going on the second court, we were across those matches. So I think my grounding was fantastic. You know, for 7-8 years, it was just three of us. And then I think in the eighth year, we had a fourth commentator. So then we'd work in pairs, which literally halved our workload. Mm-hmm. And when that becomes the norm, when the exception, it becomes the norm for you, everything else is so simple thereafter. For everything's easy thereafter. So, you know, now when I do two matches a day, if I'm working for Amazon or doing the US Open or down in Oz, it's so manageable. It's an easy day at the office, even if it's, you know, a five setter that lasts 4 hours and another one that's 3 hours after that. Everything's relative in life, and I always say that to people. But saying that, you know, sometimes if you had a couple of weeks off and after Wimby, I don't do much, and my next tournament's Canada, and I've had a 3 or 4 week break. The first couple of days, you wake up in the morning and you feel you've had a workout, man. So, yeah. And I mean, the singers, I learned a trick. I read about it, that the singers, when their voice starts to go, they gargle with honey. So
just pure honey.
Pure honey, just straight out the bottle, bud. And that lines the throat. The consistency of the honey just lines the throat a bit. So it doesn't take as much of strain. And singers, if they're having problems, they'll just go backstage and you gargle with honey and spit it out, swallow a little bit. So that's, you just get used to it, man. You just get used to it. So hopefully the voice won't go, because I'll be using it full.
I absolutely love that, Robbie. And Robbie, I can't thank you enough for doing this. This was a lot of fun. I feel like I could talk to you for another hour about your experience, but due to time restraints, I have to let you go. If you guys want to follow Robbie, definitely follow him on Twitter. Listen to him on Amazon Wimbledon Radio this year as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'll be at the US Open.
US Open, Wimbledon, Amazon, anything like that, definitely go follow Robbie's journey. And again, thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you guys soon. Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks for having me, man. Thanks so much, Phil.
Thank you.